Welcome. This is an audio recording of the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. The Council is a nonprofit membership organization dedicated to engaging the public in an exploration of global issues and foreign affairs, and we produce over 80 public events each year. To learn more about us or to become a member, visit dfwworld.org. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight I have the pleasure to welcome Mr. Danforth to the World Affairs Council. He is truly one of the most respected voices in American politics. His wisdom, his decency have been demonstrated in every area of his service. In fact, I think I'm having the same problem that President Bush had when he nominated Mr. Danforth to be our ambassador to the United Nations, because he didn't know, did we call you Attorney General? Do we call you senator? Do we call you special envoy to Sudan, ambassador to the United Nations, or reverend? Now, I think even the president said that he was tempted to call you St. Jack. But if that's even beyond the president's power, it's certainly beyond mine. But let me just say how pleased we are that you're here in Dallas. Your service to your state and to our nation is exceptional, and your integrity and thoughtful approach to some of the world's most challenging problems have only earned you more assignments for even more challenging problems. Your book just came out, and I've read the reviews, the preliminary reviews, and they're outstanding. I encourage our friends here to pick up a copy. Somebody that I always really enjoy listening to and think that he's just one of our outstanding senators is Alan Simpson. He said, "Heed the call of this certain trumpet. No one speaks with more clarity, honesty, or sincerity than my old friend, Jack Danforth." So he doesn't even know, you know, he doesn't say ambassador or whatever. When things would get rough in the U.S. Senate, he was the guy we would send off to negotiate our way of the tough problems with the troops on the other side of the aisle. Heed the thoughtful and provocative message. He always gave his very best. He again does so here in this book. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Senator John Danforth.
Thank you, sir. Thanks. Jim, thank you very much. I am filled with hope looking out over this room and seeing how many people are here. I'm delighted that you are here, and I'm going to tell you why I am delighted that you are here. This book, Faith and Politics, available at a reduced price, is not the first book I have written. And this is not the first time I have been to Dallas on a book tour. I wrote a book in the early 1990s about the great travail of my life, which was the confirmation of Justice Clarence Thomas. And I went on the book tour, and I came to Dallas. And the deal was that I was supposed to show up at one of these very large bookstores. I don't know, Barnes & Noble or Borders or something, which I did. And I was told, when you get there, introduce yourself to the manager, which I did. And the manager, this is 7 o'clock at night, and the manager said, "We've got this all set up for you. Go back to the corner there, and we've got a bunch of folding chairs and a table, and then you speak to the group and answer questions, which I will do tonight, and then sit down at the table, and we'll sell a lot of books, and you sign the books." So I said, "Great," and I went back to the corner where they had about 50 or 60 folding chairs set up, and there were three people there. So I said to myself, "Well, how do I handle this? Do I give them the full load, or do I abbreviate this?" But I thought, you know, they were nice enough to show up, and I didn't have anything else to do. So I gave them my full presentation, the three people. And then they asked, you know, 15, 20 minutes, whatever worth of questions. And at the end of this, one of them bought the book, and the other two were very nice and made for the door. Now, there are more than three people here, and maybe one of you will buy the book and the other will head for the door. Great! There's one. I've at least tied what I did in my last trip. Thanks so much for being here. I entered politics in 1968 when I first ran for Attorney General of the state of Missouri, and I served in that position for 8 years, and then I ran for the Senate and served there for 18 years. And politics and the way politics was done during the time that I was in it, and the time I was running for office, was very different than the way it is done now. At that time, it was believed that roughly, say, 30% of the population were Republicans, and roughly 30% of the population, maybe a few more, were Democrats, and roughly a third of the population were independents. And the name of the game in politics was to appeal to the independents. And that's how you won. And that was the only way I could win, because my state at that time, especially in my early years in politics, never elected Republicans. So I had to appeal to a lot of Democrats, and I especially had to get, you know, most of the votes of the independents in Missouri if I had a chance to win. That was the competition in politics. And because both Republicans and Democrats had to appeal to independents, the effect of that was to moderate politics. The center really controlled the election. We had to appeal to the center, and therefore the center had a lot of strength. Nowadays, that is not the way politics is done. I can remember prior to the 2004 election attending a Republican strategy meeting. And the big political strategists who were talking, I can remember one of them saying, only about 6% of the population is undecided. So what we have to do is not appeal to that 6%, but we have to energize the base of our party. So this is what politics has become. Not competing for the middle, but energizing the base. And each of the political parties has its base. The Democrats have their base, and the Republicans, our base, has become Christian conservatives. That is the base of the Republican Party today. So energizing the base is turning out the Christian conservatives. And the way to do it is to create a series of wedge issues for the sake of appealing to this base. And that is what the Republican Party has done. I think that the result of all of this has been a collapse of the center of American politics. And I think that that is bad for our country. Right now, the nature of politics is so partisan and so mean. Not that it was ever hearts and flowers. Politics has always been a contact sport. But now, it is so fractured on very partisan lines that it's hard to come together on almost anything. We had fights, big-time fights, when I was in the Senate. But I had the privilege of serving on the Senate Finance Committee, dealing with taxation and trade. And we always had to come together on a bipartisan basis to get anything done. In fact, one of my closest allies in the Senate, and for some time the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, was Lloyd Benson. I always worked with Lloyd Benson, very, very closely with him. And we could always make some kind of deal. That's what politics is, to pass anything. Now I believe what politics is mainly just positioning yourself for the next election. So there's a great premium on taking very hard-edged, bright line positions in order to energize your base and to distinguish your party as a party line position from the other party. Both parties do this. Now, as I said, the Republican base has become the Christian right, Christian conservatives. I have to tell you that I was late in coming to a realization of what was going on. And when I came to the realization, it was last year. Year ago last spring, about a year and a half ago. And that was the time of the Terri Schiavo case, which you remember. Terri Schiavo was a woman who had been on a feeding tube for, I think, 15 years. And her case had gone round and round in the Florida courts. And she had something like four or five different court proceedings at the trial level in the Florida courts, because the purpose of what trial courts do is determine facts. And the facts to be determined were, first, what is the condition of her brain? Was she in an irreversible state? Was she in a persistent vegetative state? And secondly, had she evinced an intent with respect to being kept alive? And the Florida courts, after numerous reviews, both at the trial level and at the appellate level, found that she was indeed in a persistent vegetative state and that she had evinced, and this was disputed by her parents, but this was held by the finder of facts, an intent not to be kept alive artificially. That's where it stood until the politicians in Washington got in the act. And Congress passed special legislation turning this matter over to a federal judge and saying, okay, Florida, you've had it. We're going to have a federal judge decide it. And Congress did this with the leadership of Republicans in Congress. And the president flew from Crawford, Texas, to Washington on Air Force One to sign this special legislation. I thought that this was just terrible. I thought it was terrible in part because, I don't know about you, but the nightmare that I have is being kept alive artificially. So I've got a living will, a durable power of attorney. Terri Schiavo didn't have that. So I thought government's involvement in this was terrible. But what puzzled me was, why did Republicans take the lead in this? It seemed to me totally contrary to the principles of the Republican Party to get involved in a case-specific matter relating to a single individual, and particularly to take the position that forget about the state of Florida. The decision-making is going to be made by Congress in Washington, D.C. I didn't think that was the Republican Party, that inside the Beltway in Washington had all of the genius. And then I thought that the basic principle, come on down and have a seat. Good. You don't have any eggs, do you? Or tomatoes? Thanks for coming. But I thought that, I mean, one of the things that I thought most Republicans believed in was a limited role of the federal judiciary. And here, suddenly, Congress had passed special legislation vesting this new power in the judiciary. So I thought that it was an abandonment of Republican principles. Why? Because religious vigils were being held in Florida, candlelight and so on, prayer meetings on courthouse steps, led by Christian conservatives, and they put pressure to bear on the politicians, and the politicians threw their principles overboard. So I thought that that was a takeover of the Republican Party. And then I began to think about other indicia of the same phenomenon. The uproar over the Ten Commandments in courthouses. And on the Capitol grounds here in Texas. I thought it was an uproar way out of proportion to the importance of having the Ten Commandments on a courthouse wall. But it was an appeal to a particular religious group. The opposition by many people in my party to early stage stem cell research. And then one of the most volatile of all issues, the attempt to define marriage in the Constitution of the United States. Now, the issue of gay marriage, people have very strong opinions of that on that, pro or con. But I couldn't imagine this being a matter that would be enshrined in the Constitution of the United States. In fact, I thought that the principle that most conservatives took with respect to the issue of abortion was that these issues should be decided by legislatures, but that they should not be enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. So I thought all of this was just an abandonment of principle in order to appeal to a political base. As I say, the Democrats have their own base, and to me, it's not a very attractive base. It consists of trial lawyers, teachers' unions, and so forth. But I'm a Republican, and I'm a practicing Christian, and I was concerned about the use of religion as a wedge in order to define a political party. I thought that it was wrong. That's what this book is about. Our country has learned the lesson, enshrined it in our Constitution, learned the lesson because of the history that we inherited from Europe, that people kill each other in the name of religion. And so religion can be just extraordinarily divisive, and we see it today in the world. The fighting that's going on in Iraq is not just you know, followers of Saddam Hussein. The bloodshed that's going on in Iraq is between two branches of Islam, the Sunnis and the Shiites, killing each other because both of them think they have a monopoly of God's truth. Now, I am, as I say, a practicing Christian. A practicing, believing, church-going, Bible-reading Christian. And I hope that my religion informs all of my life. And I don't think that we are supposed to check our religion at the door when we engage in anything, our workaday world and our political participation. But it is quite different for religion to inform our way of going about our lives and attempting faithfully to participate in politics, on one hand, and on the other hand, adopting a full-blown political agenda and representing ourselves as God's own agent in putting forth this agenda. I believe that religion does inform politics, principally for Christians, by the commandment that we love our neighbors as ourselves. But there is nothing that I see in the Bible that gives us a full-blown political agenda. And as a matter of fact, one of the messages in both the Old and New Testaments, as I read them, is that there is a difference between God's truth and our perception of God's truth. So the prophet Isaiah said, in fact, "My truth is not your truth, says the Lord." And Paul said, we see through a glass darkly. So the notion of creating a political agenda and believing that this is God's agenda and that I am God's representative, to me, is idolatry. And it is also extraordinarily divisive for a country. To create these political bases and appeal to them, to me, is bad enough. But to create a political base with the idea that we're on God's side and you are not is particularly divisive. Now, one of the questions I raise in this book, right at the beginning, is how do you view religion? Do you think religion is divisive, or do you think that it is reconciling? And a case can be made that it's divisive. Jesus said, I don't come to bring peace, I come to bring the sword. And to set father against son and mother against daughter and so on. But if you read that passage, I don't read it as Jesus saying, be divisive for the sake of being divisive. I read it as saying, if it comes to a choice in your lives between allegiance to the Lord and any other allegiance, allegiance to the Lord is paramount. But a basic theme as I read the New Testament is, as Paul says, we are to be ambassadors of reconciliation. Or as Jesus said in the high priestly prayer, he prayed that we all might be one. The meaning of the word religion, the word is derived from the same root as the word ligament, to bind things together. Now, so I wrote the book, and I'm on the speaking tour, and you know, I hope everybody who hears me reads the book, but I'm realistic enough to know that maybe for everybody who reads the book, 100 people will be at a forum like this, or hear me on radio or television, or read some article. And so I have a sense of the importance of what we're about here, because I'm telling you, you know, I didn't write this, and I'm not speaking to hear the sound of my own voice. Not that everybody, I mean, everybody who ever served in the Senate loves the sound of his own voice. So I love the sound of my own voice. But that's not the point. Because I am absolutely convinced that we are on a track now which is terribly divisive for America, and that the answer to it is for more and more and more people to think about it, to reflect on it, and to speak about it and to act. And that's why I'm here. I am here to enlist you to participate in thinking about and speaking about the divisiveness and the polarization in American politics, and the role of religion and the relationship between faith and politics. Because it's one thing for a politician to kind of sidle up to somebody and say, psst, I'm on your side, I've got your agenda in mind. But it's another thing to have this publicly discussed. And I think that this divisiveness in America cannot stand the light of day. And that most people in our country, notwithstanding the thought that some have that only 6% are undecided, but I believe that most people in America, if they were asked the question, don't you think that this polarization has gone too far, would say, yes, it has. And most people in America, if you ask them, do you believe that America should be divided on the basis of religion? Most people would say absolutely not. And I'm not talking about non-believers only or non-Christians only. I'm talking about right across the faith line, including evangelical Protestants. Most people would say, in this country, we're all in this together. And we've got to hang together. And we cannot let religion divide us, even though it's viewed as a wonderful political strategy to do that. So that's what the book's about, and that's why I'm here. And I probably talked at you for an unbearable amount of time, but as I say, I love the sound of my voice. So what I'd like to do now is to just open it up to you and for whatever you'd like to say or talk about, and I'll just call on you. Or do you want to call on me? The question is, we've had a Catholic president, we have had a Jewish candidate for vice president, and now there is a Mormon, and of course George was his father, right? was kind of a favorite. He made a slip up about he was brainwashed, but I think the American people are beyond this. I really do. I don't think the American people are going to vote for or against somebody because of religion. At least I hope not. I don't think so. Question of the UN, and I did not see President Chavez's speech or hear about it. I was on a plane all day. I was on the Chris Matthews program, and he asked me about it, and I said, I don't know, I was on a plane, but he repeated some of it to me. Well, it's just so outrageous, you know. I wouldn't think that would do President Chavez's cause much good, but I used to think of the General Assembly as the Cave of the Winds. I mean, it really doesn't have any power. It's just a place of making speeches and taking ridiculous positions, and so that's how I viewed that. The Security Council is a different matter, and the Security Council is the only place in the UN where there's any power. But because of the veto that five nations have in the Security Council, the resolutions that the Council comes up with tend to be extremely weak. For example, we passed a resolution when I was there relating to the presence of Syria in Lebanon. We barely passed it, and the only way we could pass it is not mention the word Syria in the resolution. So they tend to be very weak resolutions. On the other hand, when the U.S. had the presidency of the Security Council when I was there, we took the entire Security Council to Nairobi, Kenya, during the peace talks, the so-called North-South peace talks in Sudan, the problem that was solved, at least for now. And the presence of the Security Council in Nairobi, putting the squeeze on both sides, was enormously effective. So when the Security Council members can speak with one voice, that can be very effective. And the other thing about the United Nations is that I think there are now 192 members of the United Nations, and it's the one place in the world where all the countries are. And I never had any problem in people telling me exactly what they thought, and I thought it was a good listening post. Plus, there are various agencies, the World Food Program and so on, that do a lot of good. So I think that there are real pluses in the United Nations, even though it's very aggravating, especially in the General Assembly. And when you have some mountebank like President Chavez making a speech like that, it's enough to make you tear your hair out. Well, I'm sure that there are countries that would applaud it. You know, the Cubans would applaud it, and who knows who else. But I think that kind of rhetoric probably does not serve his cause very well. Question about whether campaign finance reform would help politics much. I had thought that campaign finance reform was a little bit off the point. I still think that the problem with political campaigns is not so much the financing of them, but the format of them. It's all 30-second commercials, and 30-second commercials are good for absolutely nothing except hit jobs. So when, say, in the Senate, each party is setting up votes, instead of trying to reach some kind of agreement, setting up votes for the next campaign, they do that with the next 30-second commercial in the campaign in mind. So I thought that the best campaign reform would be to provide some mechanism for candidates to appear on television for longer blocks of time, even 5 or 10 minutes, and that would be very positive. Now, secondly, campaign finance reform is hard to do without creating a lot of loopholes because of what the Supreme Court has said about the constitutionality of spending money in campaigns. So it's hard to do. Let me just add one other point, and this is something I really hadn't thought about, except people have told me this. when candidates now have to raise money relentlessly, and that means that, you know, the Senate, for example, is, I mean, if you want to schedule votes, schedule them on Wednesday, because people are going to be gone Monday, they're going to leave on Thursday, they're going to be gone Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And one of the things that does is remove opportunities for interaction with one another. So you sort of show up, you vote, you show up for a day, for 2 days, and the opportunities to interact are much less because of relentless fundraising. It's just that I don't really know what to do about it. Yeah, I mean, that's what the book is about. And let me back up just for a moment if I can. You know, religion can have very positive influences too, and that's, I also write about that. I mean, for example, the focus on Sudan and the reason President Bush asked me to be a special envoy, a lot of that was brought about by the interest of religious people from a variety of perspectives in the United States about the situation in Sudan. So religion can be very constructive. It's just that when it turns into a full-fledged agenda and I'm on God's side and you're an enemy of God, the hard-edged approach to religion that becomes very divisive. Now, what to do about it? I say that, you know, there are sort of three elements of approaching it. The first is, from the standpoint of the religious bodies themselves, to ask the question, is religion reconciling or is it a divisive force? And for theologians and people in theological seminaries and people in pulpits and people in congregations, from the standpoint of their faith perspective, to think theologically about whether their faith is divisive or whether the ministry of reconciliation is their ministry. Secondly, from the standpoint of politicians, I've got sort of a part of a chapter on that. And I think that it's important for politicians to do two things. One, to try to reconstitute the center. And I've got an example in the book about, you know, how we tried to do that on one issue. And in addition to reconstituting the center, to focus on some specific problems and to try to solve the problems. Because right now we are not solving the problems. I will give you some examples. The future of Medicare and Social Security. The energy dependence of the United States. We are not solving that problem, nor are we thinking seriously about how to handle terrorism and how to handle rogue states. It's as though both parties are writing campaign speeches and not really dealing with it in a sense of, you know, what how are we going to get our act together? So I think that from the standpoint of the politicians, but most important, the most important factor in American political life is you. The ordinary citizen. People say politicians don't listen. Baloney. They listen to a fault, if anything. They're so attuned to what their constituents are saying. And if their constituents, if what they hear from the constituents are things like weigh in on Terry Schiavo or amend the Constitution to define marriage, that's what they're going to do. But if they hear from people who say, what are we doing? How did we get into this? You know, when that marriage amendment was on the floor of the Senate, I was in Monterey, California at the Naval Graduate School out there speaking to a bunch of sort of junior officers. They were kind of captains and, well, whatever, lieutenant commanders and that kind of a rank. And one of these young men stood up and he said, "I have served two tours in Iraq. What are they doing with that issue on the floor of the United States Senate?" I mean, I don't know what his position was on gay marriage. He's probably totally against it. But the question is, how did we get into that box? And I believe that when politicians hear from the public relentlessly that we have gone too far in polarization and that religion should not be a wedge, that's when we're going to get off of this thing. So how do you make your voices heard? In the usual ways. Speaking to politicians, sending them emails, going to their town hall meetings and standing up and asking questions, writing letters to the editor, all the ways, and voting and contributing to the candidate of your choice. But you've got the power. And what I'm trying to do is to create this, help encourage a big chorus on the subject, so it's not, you know, just good old Jack chattering away. Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know the facts, but you know, in the Internal Revenue Code, if you can jeopardize, the church can jeopardize its tax exempt status by being too political and endorsing candidates. But I think that the adroit church does it anyhow. I mean, I used to go around to churches on the Sunday before elections, and a lot of candidates do. And Republicans go to conservative churches, and Democrats go to black churches, and if you're not endorsed from the pulpit, it's a pretty good embrace that you receive. So I think that I can't imagine churches being so heavy-handed that they're going to fall into that particular trap. I don't know the case you're talking about. The question has to do with whether there could be some sort of strategy relating to reconciling religious problems internationally. Clearly, a lot of the problems, conflict problems in the world, have a religious component to them. We talked earlier about Iraq with the Shiites and the Sunnis killing each other in Iraq. Sudan, where when I was involved, the North-South problem in Sudan, not Darfur really, but North-South, there was definitely a religious component in that. What's the application of Sharia law to non-Muslims, that kind of thing. Kashmir, Northern Ireland, Bosnia, there's a history of a religious element in political conflict. And sometimes it's the dominant element in those conflicts. So what to do about it? My view is that if religion is the problem, then people of faith should take the leadership in trying to resolve the problem. And so I had this idea with respect to Sudan that there should be a mediation service, an interfaith mediation service to address specific issues like does Sharia law apply in the capital of Khartoum, that kind of thing. What requirements should there be to get permission to build a church because the Christian churches couldn't build their churches? Specific issues and to try to mediate those issues. And the Christian clergy with whom I met in Sudan just were so anxious to get out of the country that they were not interested in it. When I was in the United Nations, I had the same idea of creating, under the auspices of the Security Council, because the Security Council's responsibility is maintaining peace, creating a religious mediation service people who were both experts, who were trained in dispute resolution and also trained in the content of religion and religious disputes to try to mediate these problems. It got nowhere. I mean, I wasn't there very long, but it just didn't get very far. The Philippines were in the Security Council at the time. They were interested in it, but like the Chinese, they didn't want it. They didn't want it, and so that got nowhere. But I think that there is no reason why religious leaders couldn't themselves start such an initiative and make that, whatever the facility is, available, say, to the Security Council or to the Secretary General. So that's what I would like to see happen. I would like to see some major religious leaders try to put something together and offer it to the international community. And by the way, you know, there was so much publicity about the unfortunate statement that the Pope made, for which he has profusely apologized. But as I understand his statement, what he was saying is that we need to do a better job of communicating and having interfaith dialogue. And I think that that is a very, very important thing. And just one last point on this subject. Going way back to the days of St. Augustine, the notion of just war and what is and what is not just war. And one of the ancient concepts is non-combatant immunity. That is, that civilians are not to be targeted. That would be a very interesting question for interfaith dialogue, because clearly now in a world of terror, civilians are targeted, and I think people of faith should speak to this issue and do it very clearly. Without getting into the particulars of who should try terrorists and so on, I mean, if you view that as more of a military confrontation than a criminal issue, then I don't think that that is a matter for Article III courts, but more generally to your point, when there is a Supreme Court confirmation before the Senate, and there's this tremendous uproar about the confirmation, and there is repeated questioning of nominees, particularly on the issue of abortion, the questioning is not a matter of question. They're not questions about judicial philosophy. You know, how literally do you read constitutional language? That's not the question. The real question is, how are you going to vote? And that is what the public focuses on, and that is what the media focuses on. And even very sophisticated media, New York Times editorial page, what they focus on is, what are the results going to be? So in the minds of the public and in the minds of the media, the federal judiciary has been transformed into a third political branch of government. And when it's transformed into a third political branch of government, it is not viewed with the kind of deference that the judiciary should be viewed with. It's simply viewed as, here are a bunch of politicians who nobody elected. And so my answer to your question is, to create a better public understanding of what the appropriate role of courts is. And I think that is a big educational process that we should all, and I think judges could help with that educational process. Clearly the media could help too.
Thank you very much.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.